The Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Members, please turn on your microphones when responding to the roll call. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Avila.
Here.
Vice Chair Yarborough.
Here.
Representatives Altman.
Here.
Barnaby.
Here.
Ranking Member Brown.
Here.
Representatives Driscoll.
Here.
Duran, excused. Harding.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Saroy.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tribuzzi.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina. Members, today, well, before we get into that, members, please make sure, and those in the audience, please make sure that your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, today we have two agenda items for our meeting. We will vote on our appropriation project consent agenda first. Then we will continue our discussion from last week on CARES Act funding. The focus of this week's discussion will be on how the CARES Act funding was utilized by the top 10 hospitals that received the highest amount of relief funds. So let's go to the consent agenda, members. We will take up the consent agenda and vote once on the agenda in its entirety. The public is welcome to testify on any of the bills listed on the consent agenda. Members, we will not take up question, debate, and vote on each of these bills individually. Instead, we will be in questions and debate only once. Remember, you may vote no on any particular bill by submitting a nay vote consent agenda form with the administrative assistant before the vote. Please keep in mind that passing these bills simply makes these projects eligible for funding, but does not guarantee that these projects will be funded or funded at the requested level. With that being said, are there any questions? Members, are there any questions? Is there public testimony? And there is. We have Teresa Bolger with the Clark School for Hearing and Speech. Just make sure to press the button there. Give it a shot now, ma'am.
Okay.
There we
go. Am I better?
You're good, ma'am. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
So as I'll be very brief, and I just want to thank you for both putting on the agenda and allowing me to speak today on behalf of children who are deaf and are learning to listen and talk in Florida. You know, they say talk is cheap, but it's priceless if you're a child who's deaf. It's a very hard thing to achieve. And it's not an inexpensive thing to achieve. We know that children who are deaf and who don't learn to listen and talk cost us as taxpayers about $1 million per child in terms of special assistance that they need, interpreters, special education, etc. But this project makes it possible for about 550 to 600 children who are deaf, born deaf, profoundly deaf, to learn to listen and speak for themselves. And that opens a whole world for them. Not only can they tell their parents that they love them or ask for directions to a restroom, but they can compete on par with their typically hearing peers in their neighborhood schools. In fact, currently 99.8% of the children who have attended the auditory oral programs are mainstreamed by kindergarten. And they no longer cost us any special education dollars moving forward. So there are tremendous savings. This money has traditionally been used to attract grant funding from others and generally results in a 5-to-1 match. Private foundations are not allowed to lobby, and they view saying that they're offering a match as lobbying, so we're only allowed to say that it attracts their funding. So that is all I really want to say to you, except that imagine that your child is born deaf, and it could be any one of your children. 95% of children born deaf are born to typically hearing parents who have no knowledge of any of this. And thanks to newborn hearing screening, are thrown into this really fast. So now your child is identified, they're amplified at 3 to 6 months, and the goal is to get them back into the mainstream. And then after that, you have often seen the children visiting in the past. We hope that COVID will pass and we'll be back to see you again soon. But in the meanwhile, I have them on my heart, and I hope that you have them on yours as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am. And Ms. Bolger represents the Clark School for Hearing and Speech, also the Florida Academy of Audiology, the Florida Coalition for Spoken Language Choices, and the Sertoma Speech and Hearing Foundation, and clearly is a proponent. Thank you, ma'am. We have Kathy Vergara with the University of Miami Debbie School. Ma'am, you are recognized.
Thank you. Thank you so much for allowing us to be here today. I came all the way up from Miami to talk to you about this important bill for young children with hearing loss. We have an auditory oral program at the Debbie School at the University of Miami. The Debbie School is part of the medical school, and we're a demonstration school. This bill allows parents the opportunity for early intervention for their children with hearing loss. Hearing loss is known as a neurological emergency. So if a child is born deaf or with hearing loss and the parents don't have the opportunity to access early intervention for their child, then their child is not going to develop language in a normal fashion, and then they're going to need services for the rest of our life. Because of this bill, it's so important for children throughout the state. But in South Florida, we're able to reach out to children all the way to Key West and all the way up to St. Lucie County and beyond. And then we also are able to provide telehealth services for families throughout South Florida and some families in Central Florida. So it's a very, very important opportunity for families. And as Teresa said, as a result of this early intervention, the majority of the children are able to go into general education. And then they can go on to maximize their individual potentials. Many of our children have gone to universities and are working as very productive citizens. So it's an important it's very important on the return on investment for taxpayers, because it saves money for them being to need interpreters and support for the rest of their lives. Instead, they become very productive citizens, and very frequently their families come back and express their deep appreciation for the opportunity that their children have when they have early intervention. So it's a very, very important bill for our children, and it would just be simply devastating if they weren't able to have the support. So thank you so very, very much for allowing us to be here and to express our reason for thinking that this is so important. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. So Ms. Vergara is a proponent of House Bill 2381, as well as Mrs. Bolger. So just wanted to state that for the record. We have Mary Lynn Cullen with the Advocacy Institute for Children, waving in support of House Bill 2381. We have Alejandro Gonzalez with the United Way of Broward County, waving in support for House Bill 2511. Also have Alejandro Gonzalez waving in support from the United Way of Broward County, waving in support of House Bill 2897. Again, Alejandro Gonzalez with the United Way of Broward County, waving in support for House Bill 3939. Alejandro Gonzalez with the United Way of Broward County, waving in support of House Bill 3981. And lastly, Alejandro Gonzalez with the United Way of Broward County, waving in support of House Bill 3983. So members, that does it for public testimony. We're now in debate. We're now in debate on the consent agenda. Is there a debate? Seeing no debate, before I call the vote on the consent agenda, are there any nay vote forms? Okay. So Sabrina, will you please call the roll on the consent agenda? Remember, a yes vote signifies an affirmative vote for every bill on the consent agenda, with the exception of any no votes, of which there are none. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Avila?
Yes.
Vice Chair Yarbrough?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Barnaby?
Yes.
Ranking Member Brown?
Yes.
Representatives Driscoll?
Yes.
Duran? Representatives Harding?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Salzman?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith? Snyder?
Yes.
Trabuzzi?
Yes.
13 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Sabrina. Please show the consent agenda passes. All of the bills on the consent agenda will be reported favorably. Okay, now members, we're going to move on to our second round of the CARES Act funding discussion. In this particular segment, we're going to, again, focus on the top 10 hospitals that received the highest amount of relief funds. And members, to start, there's no doubt that doctors, nurses, and healthcare staff have played an integral role during the COVID-19 pandemic response effort. We appreciate their service and their dedication to our residents. However, our obligation as an appropriations subcommittee is to examine every aspect of the healthcare budget and determine a responsible course of action. Moreover, it is incumbent on us to assess the amount of funds from external sources, state agencies, and internal operating reserves. As I stated in last week's meeting, the total amount of self-reported CARES Act funds totals greater than $2.9 billion. This amount is larger than our entire statewide budget shortfall of $2.75 billion, as reported in the long-range financial outlook adopted by the Legislative Budget Commission. The top 10 hospitals that received the largest relief funds totals $928.8 million. For some perspective, this is greater than the GDP of 13 nations. Prior to this meeting, I requested additional data on how the CARES Act relief funds were utilized. We received data from all of the 10 hospitals. However, one hospital will be submitting an updated breakdown of expenditures of CARES Act funding. We would like now to welcome Mary Mayhew, the president and CEO of the Florida Hospital Association, and Justin Senior, the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida, to provide further detail on this new data. You may now provide an opening statement if you have one. Members, we will now turn it over to Justin Senior and Mary Mayhew.
Sure. Members of the committee, thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Justin Senior. I am the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance.
Could you check the mic?
to working now?
There we go.
Okay. I'm the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance. We are an alliance of 14 hospital systems running from Pensacola down to Miami and everywhere in between.
You might have to bring it a little closer in.
I might take the mask off.
Try it now. That's a little better.
Okay.
There we go.
14 hospital systems running from Pensacola down to Miami and everywhere in between. Our hospitals are teaching hospitals, they are children's hospitals, and they are public hospitals, as well as something called a regional perinatal intensive care hospital. Five of the hospitals that were listed on as being top 10 recipients of provider relief funds were our members, and they're on the sheet, one of the sheets that we supplied to the committee. They're Jackson Memorial in Miami, Memorial Regional in Broward County, Nicholas Children's in Miami-Dade, Orlando Health, and then UF Health Jacksonville are the five. I can tell you, and I talked to you about this last week, the provider relief funds really were a lifeline for our hospitals. They were not a windfall, and ultimately the losses incurred by our hospitals and the additional expenses incurred by our hospitals were substantially larger than any money we received from the provider relief fund. That was a bit of a source of frustration during the course of last year, but ultimately we were able to use the provider relief funds by and large to avoid some of the worst consequences of the revenue losses and the additional expenses. When it comes to the provider relief fund itself, it was designed not to be a windfall. The federal government designed it specifically so that it would compensate for lost revenue, and they gave you different ways of calculating and tell you how you can calculate your lost revenue, and also said that it could be used to offset expenses that you incurred in the pandemic, and they define the expenses that you could use the provider relief funds for. Ultimately, you are not allowed to take more than your losses and your expenses, and the final accounting for the program is actually right now scheduled to occur in July. You can see on our sheet here that we supplied a lot of red numbers, and ultimately none of our members did end up positive from it. There are a couple of reasons for that. Ultimately, obviously, you're not allowed to be positive, but the reason that there are a lot of red numbers there had to do with some of the ways that the funds were released by the federal government. There was a brief time period in the second half of May of last year where the country thought that it might be getting through the pandemic, that the big wave that had hit New York and that it hit the Northeast and the Midwest was subsiding and that there were clearer skies ahead. With that in mind, the federal government designed what they called a hotspot tranche. This was money that was designed to go to hospitals that had seen a disproportionate share of COVID patients, and they sent the money out based on that. They defined COVID hotspots based on the number of COVID patients you had seen between January 1st of 2020 and June 11th of 2020. And that definition with the June 11th cutoff came out at the end of May and early June. At that point, everyone thought briefly that we might be through the worst of it. Unfortunately, the huge wave that hit Florida started on June the 12th and lasted through July and into August. So a lot of the money that went out to hospitals that were supposedly COVID hotspots ended up disproportionately in New York, New Jersey, Michigan, and elsewhere. And that was something that we were never quite able as a state to catch up on because they had obligated so much of the provider relief funds at that moment. I can tell you, though, that having received these funds, it really was a lifeline for our hospitals. We have a couple of exceptions, and Nicholas Children's, unfortunately, was one of them. But for the most part, our hospitals were able to avoid layoffs, and they were able to avoid salary cuts in the middle of a pandemic. And it allowed our hospitals, from the beginning to the end, to play a really important role at every stage of the pandemic without being in a situation where you were laying people off and destroying morale. At the early stage of the pandemic, people forget now because testing is very widely available and there are a lot of tests that are a lot less expensive and a lot simpler to administer. But in the early days of the pandemic, the testing that had to be done in very sophisticated labs with really highly credentialed and experienced lab staff. And our hospitals had that. And so we could actually turn around the tests significantly faster in the early days than even the state lab could, often within 24 hours, which was something that was critical, that we, sort of a resource that we were able to bring to bear early on in the pandemic to help people identify who had COVID and who didn't, so that we could make sure that people who were COVID positive weren't being discharged to nursing facilities and other things like that. Over the summer, our hospitals engaged in clinical trials, their role as academic medical centers and as public hospitals. So our hospitals participated in the clinical trials for the antibody treatments, including the hospitals on this list, as well as clinical trials for remdesivir and others to help advance the science and improve the treatment, shorten the hospital stays and improve the outcomes during the course of the pandemic. And then more recently, we were able to participate heavily in the vaccination effort, both vaccinating frontline healthcare workers, but also identifying the most fragile, medically fragile patients in the state of Florida undergoing active cancer treatments, having received transplants, and also help them kind of pull them to safety through the vaccination effort. And we're able to do that because, again, some of the early vaccines really required this ultra cold storage, and there were a limited number of facilities that were able to do it. And the initial five hospitals that were selected to sort of quarterback the effort, several of them are on this list, and four of them were safety net hospitals. The fifth was Advent. And they were, we were able, I think, successfully to get the rollout going well. I'm certainly happy to answer any specific questions about the types of things that our hospitals experienced. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. It's been an interesting and extremely difficult year. We hope that there are better days ahead, and we're really anxious and looking forward to working with the committee on and better healthcare for all for all Floridians.
Thank you, Mr. Senior. Mrs. Mayhew, you're recognized.
There we go.
There we
go. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity to be back here in front of you. I will be brief. Clearly, as you state, there are economic challenges facing Florida across all of our sectors, from government to the private sector, and certainly in healthcare. I shared with you last time, as we calculate the losses sustained, the revenue losses when procedures that could be scheduled, still critical procedures could be scheduled that were restricted under a statewide restriction, the costs incurred around supplies and staffing, even net of the federal relief funds received by hospitals, we conservatively estimate the net loss to hospitals at $2.5 billion. To put into context, of course, all of the financial challenges that our state faces. Within that, over $4 billion in revenue losses and certainly cost increases. As we discussed before, Florida hospitals received $2.2 billion in CARES funding. Of the 10 hospitals that you are focused on here, I also think it's important to point out that of those hospitals and health systems, they represent 11,857 hospital beds. Advent Health, as an example, Advent Health Orlando, that represents over 8 hospitals under that one license, over 3,000 beds. So significant capacity reflected in those numbers of those top 10, which correlates to the relief funding that they received. Our hospitals have been and continue to be on the front lines responding to this unprecedented pandemic. As a state, we have depended on the nurses, the physicians, the respiratory therapists, and countless other healthcare staff to care for those with COVID, to respond to the needs of their communities. Justin talked about it, just the nature of a virus that we have learned something new about almost every single day from the beginning of this pandemic and what that involved. I think, you know, over time we may have forgotten, as was described, what it was like when we couldn't get test results back for 3, 4, 5, 7 days and what that involved in terms of the use of PPE, the hospital beds that were occupied. To protect our elderly and other vulnerable individuals, hospitals quickly stood up remote patient monitoring so that they didn't risk exposure in the community. Hospitals engaged with nursing homes and assisted living facilities and other congregate residential long-term care providers in a manner that is absolutely unprecedented and saved lives. Hospitals were involved in accepting transfers of nursing home residents, assisted living facility residents, not because they needed hospital level of care, but because we were trying to protect and prevent the deadly spread of the virus. There were many, thousands of individuals who were in our hospital beds so that we could prevent 5 cases from becoming 50 in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Hospitals urgently stood up vaccination sites to assist with the rapid deployment of vaccine, and our hospitals struggled to weather the financial challenges of the weeks where scheduled surgeries, procedures, and screenings were prohibited. Difficult decisions were made while at the same time fearing the surge and planning for and preparing for the capacity that was necessary to meet the anticipated demand. In the second quarter of 2020, when the restriction on electives was in place, hospitals experienced a 38% reduction in emergency room visits, 32% decrease in surgeries at hospital ambulatory surgical centers, and an 18% reduction in inpatient discharges. Their response, their role, their efforts were all made without any guarantee that federal funding would be provided to cover these significant revenue losses and cost increases. Hospitals have been paying their bills, meeting payroll, buying PPE, paying for the vital COVID-19 treatments, converting rooms to ICU level of care, converting other non-patient space to meet increasing patient demands. Over 300,000 employees, $20 billion in wages. We all monitored around the state daily the numbers of hospital beds available. We depended on their local leadership to refine and implement their surge plans to respond to this historic public health crisis. Much like our state economy, it is difficult to predict the short and long-term consequences of this crisis on our healthcare system. We know there is pent-up demand, and we know that we currently have significant workforce challenges. It is also important to note that while the total net losses are over $2 billion, even after the CARES funding, the impact certainly varies. Our rural hospitals saw the impact of the lost revenue and the increased PPE and supply costs without seeing any increase in inpatient admissions over the last year. Our pediatric hospitals also saw a dramatic reduction in services that continues to persist, along with the increased costs of staffing, PPE, and supplies. As I mentioned last week, that delay in care is resulting in some children and adults presenting with their illnesses far progressed. Again, I appreciate the opportunity, the data that has been presented, the information provided. Clearly, we understand the challenges that the state faces, that our healthcare system continues to face. We all want this pandemic in our rearview mirror, and we want to ensure that we have a vibrant healthcare system that is at the ready to provide high-quality care and to respond to the next emergency, to the next crisis, as it has done throughout the last year. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Members, questions. Ranking Member Brown, you're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you too for being here today. And I have a series of questions, actually. But
you're recognized for a series of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is essentially, or was it essentially the federal government's intent for the funding that was provided to the hospitals to kind of make you all whole as though a pandemic had never happened, and this is hold in the sense of financially? Did that money, was the intent of that money given to make you all whole financially as though the pandemic never happened?
I think it's fair to say that it was in order to avoid the worst effects of the pandemic. It was given out to make sure that hospitals would be able to make to be able to afford the expenses, the additional expenses associated with taking care of COVID patients, and also to make sure that there weren't going to be layoffs, mass layoffs in the middle of the pandemic. To that extent, you know, hospitals do have a budget, right, during the course of the year, so they have expenses that they've undertaken. And yes, the idea was to make sure that they would be able to make payroll, to make their payments, and to continue their operations with minimal disruption to try to get the best result possible.
And if you can just sort of talk about, because I know we've kind of heard some of the latter, but if you all can sort of elaborate on some of those successes due to the COVID Act funding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, to comment on the intent, I think, you know, there was a lot of frustration, as Justin mentioned, in terms of how those federal dollars flowed and the different tranches and how those were defined. Significant disparity, largely influenced by that initial significant spike occurring in the Northeast. So Florida did not receive the level of funding, as we mentioned last time. New York received $12 billion. Florida received $4 billion. Just a dramatic disparity in how the dollars were distributed. And again, as we also indicated, the guidance of how those dollars could be used has changed at least 3 to 4 times over the course of the last year, which for hospitals, as they're dealing with their end-of-year financial statements, are certainly very concerned about any potential clawback as they plan, as they budget. As I mentioned, in terms of the types of costs and the revenues lost statewide, and this is based upon a survey that the Florida Hospital Association did, we had over 106 hospitals respond. There were $3 billion in revenue losses, as I mentioned, between the restriction on electives, the fear of the public in accessing services even after that statewide restriction was lifted, and then certainly in July and August, and then this past November, December, January, hospitals independently had to restrict services in order to preserve bed capacity. So $3 billion in revenues lost that would have been part of how hospitals planned and established their budgets for 2020. Over $560 million in supplies, PPE, and other costs. $347 million related to staffing. So significant cost drivers that clearly were not part of any budget that any hospital would have anticipated as they built their budget and planned for their finances to manage 2020.
Mr. Chair, sure. I'll give you one example, and I'll use Jackson Health because they're on the list. One of the things that they were able to do, and one of the things that I think really helped the state of Florida get a better result, people would come into the hospital COVID positive, they'd be very sick. At a certain point, you'd stabilize them. They would no longer need to be in the hospital, but they were still testing positive for COVID. And so in some states, very infamously at this point, those people were discharged to nursing facilities or to assisted living facilities anyway. In the state of Florida, we tried to set up COVID-only locations where people could be discharged from the hospital so they were no longer an infection risk within the hospital. They no longer needed to be in the hospital, but not send them back to a nursing facility or assisted living facility. And Jackson Health worked to convert one of their long-term acute care facilities into a COVID-only facility. And I say this, Secretary Mayhew, as secretary of the agency, was really instrumental in helping set this up. And this is something that Lee Health did in Lee County, that Nicholas Children's Hospital did down in Miami with a hospital facility they have near the airport. There were a lot of people pitching in to try to convert these facilities and staff these facilities as COVID-only entities that could relieve pressure on the hospitals so the hospitals wouldn't get swamped, which is why some of those other states ordered the discharges, but at the same time not sending it back to nursing facilities. And all of this costs money to set that up logistically and to do it, and these are the types of things that the Provider Relief Fund enabled.
Thank you so much. My next question is, if hospitals saw pretty much a decline in patient volume and revenue, especially early on when there was a cut or a request to discontinue any of the elective procedures, did COVID patients sort of fill in the gap there at your hospitals?
The answer is no, and then almost. So there are two different phases of this. The first was that there was a mandatory shutdown to conserve personal protective equipment, which was a global supply chain issue back that lasted from about March the 20th to May the 4th. During that time period, there was a state emergency order telling hospitals to postpone all non-emergent procedures if they could be safely postponed. And at that point, we actually were expecting this surge that people were seeing around the country, and there was a lot of chatter that, well, we're 3 weeks behind New York. What they're seeing, we're going to see in about 3 weeks. That never materialized. So what you had was a very small, number of COVID patients in a hospital. You had an active maternity ward, and then you had a lot of vacancy in between. And so, no, at that point, there really were not enough COVID patients to make up for any revenue losses. Later on in the summer, we actually had a huge surge of COVID patients, which really strained capacity. And as I said at the meeting last week, one of the phenomena that we were seeing was that your staff lives in the community. Your nurses, your doctors, your all of the staff that make up the hospital work in the community. They catch it in the community. You test them in the morning, and those types of tests were one of the additional expenses associated with it. They test positive, they get knocked offline. They had to hire, they had to bring in staff augmentation to bring people in and things like that. At that point, several hospitals in Miami-Dade County that are on this list, as well as in Broward County, as well as Lee County, there may have been one or two others in July and August, had to voluntarily postpone procedures to make sure they could free up staff. And at that point, they did have a substantial number of COVID patients. It didn't quite make up for the difference, so there were still losses in July and August, but they were narrower. The bigger losses were back in the spring.
Thank you so much. Next question is, did any of our hospitals sort of statewide get more federal funding than they lost? Of all of them, not just the 10, but any of them received more federal funding?
We have not identified any hospital where their revenue losses or their cost increases exceeded their CARES relief dollars. Again, the CARES funding has certain restrictions on it in terms of what expenses can be considered, how the revenue losses are defined. The reason that any hospital might contemplate, as I mentioned, returning any of those dollars is because the guidance has constantly changed and there is a risk or a fear of a clawback. You don't want to be treating as income dollars that the federal government may, through a reconciliation request, come back. There are hospitals that are continuing to incur expenses. There is still a reduction in healthcare utilization because of the fear that the public has about returning. So those costs persist. As we mentioned last week, there in this latest package in Washington that is going through Congress, it does not include any additional direct relief to hospitals, even though their costs are continuing. Labor costs remain higher. The competition for labor around the country drove up substantially what hospitals were having to pay to retain and to hire bedside staff. The contracted staff that hospitals have had to rely upon throughout the pandemic, much higher than they would normally pay. So those costs continue to exceed, the revenues lost continue to exceed what they received in fair and CARES funding.
And my last question, so that I can allow some of my colleagues to ask questions. So we're just sort of 2 months from Florida's one-day peak. I believe that happened in January, as it relates to the new cases. Are hospitals still making expenditures due to COVID-19 as defined by the CARES Act? And if so, is this conversation that we're having still a little too premature to kind of see what those losses still will be?
The answer, Mr. Chair, the short answer is yes. They're still, the pandemic is not over yet. We are still incurring expenses, and there's still an elevated number of COVID patients in the state who are in the hospital with a primary diagnosis of COVID-19. And you can see that on some of the data that the state puts out. It has been getting better in recent weeks, but we're still, I think, just over 3,000 patients on the ACLA website, and there's different ways of counting it. It can be a little bit more than that in some methods of counting it, because there are some patients have COVID but aren't necessarily in the hospital for it. The short answer is that we're still in the pandemic, and we're hopeful that it is coming to a close, and that the better days are ahead, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that that happens.
Yes, the answer is yes, and that under the CARES relief funding, they have through July to review their expenses and their revenue loss as they report to the federal government.
Representative Duran, you're recognized for a question.
Mr. Speaker, and I guess it's a little bit more specific into that question that Rep. Brown had just brought up. With respect to the vaccination effort that's going on, I imagine that there are associated, I don't know if it's been reimbursed, if there's any funding that's been highlighted or itemized for vaccinations. If you can kind of comment on what the ongoing cost, if that's, what that looks like for the hospital system.
You're recognized.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, there are costs associated with it, and particularly with the storage, and also with getting staff and dedicating staff to do the vaccinations themselves. In addition to that, a lot of our members have set up outposts. They've set up off-location sites to make it easier for the public to get to them. They've worked with churches. They've worked with they've worked with community centers in trying to set up locations that are easily accessible. Our hospitals were really very, very involved in the initial effort, first for frontline healthcare workers, obviously, but also then for the 65 and over population back in January. As the storage capability has kind of expanded, there's been a lot more use of pharmacy locations and things like that, and so our hospitals have been able to focus on finding medically fragile patients, ones under 65 that really could use the vaccine, so we can kind of pull them to safety because they're the most vulnerable. But yes, identifying those patients, setting up locations where they can get the vaccination, staffing those locations, there are definitely costs. I mean, our hospitals are public hospitals. They're nonprofit. They just did it. There is an expectation that there will be something, and I think there was something in the most recent relief bill that does involve vaccinations, so we'd be hopeful for it. But it's a matter of, you know, we serve the community. We're public hospitals. We're teaching hospitals. You got to do it, and then we'll ask questions later. I think that a lot of trust built up between state officials and hospitals during the course of the year, so when they ask us to do something like that, we were on board.
Representative, I would just say that the magnitude of the logistics of what hospitals stood up in order to quickly respond to the request to support the rapid deployment of vaccines, it's hard to put in words. We don't typically have healthy people go to the hospital to get vaccinated. So this was not infrastructure that was readily available where a switch could be flipped and turned on. So hospitals responded to the request very quickly. And as you recall, this was mid-December when that initial deployment occurred with the vaccines, initially to the five, and then expanded statewide to all hospitals to not only vaccinate their staff, but to vaccinate medical personnel in the community, which involved the same outreach that Justin described with the medically vulnerable, to use sites to identify physical space where you could have the safe spacing, no lines forming, all scheduled, redeploy their staff. We don't have staff that are just waiting in the wings to administer vaccines, so they had to take staff from their medical practices. I know hospitals that were trying to recruit some of their retired nurses back into service to help with the vaccines. And certainly many hospitals paid for contracted agency staffing to support those vaccine efforts. It isn't clear how much of those costs will be covered from any of the latest rounds of funding.
Representative Robinson for a question. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I think probably my question may be directed better to you, Ms. Mayhew. For the lost revenues, is that just a simple calculation of comparing 2019 to 2020? Is that how that's defined? And do you see that situation improving over the next several months, given where our economy hopefully is going?
You're recognized.
Thank you. And some of this depends also pertains to the changing goalposts in Washington as they have redefined, in particular, the revenue losses. Most hospitals are looking at this based upon what did they budget for 2020 and what have in terms of revenues and what the impact for the pandemic has been in terms of lost revenues. You asked about the trend, and so we are looking at, as I mentioned, that second quarter, comparing 2019 second quarter to 2020 second quarter, where we had the dramatic reductions in ER use, inpatient admissions, ambulatory surgical centers. We've looked at the third quarter. It has improved slightly, but still pretty significant reductions in revenue. And again, as hospitals budgeted and planned for 2020, this is such a disruption to traditionally the volume that we would anticipate. It is hard to predict. What we are seeing is as people get vaccinated, they're now making their medical appointments. They're starting to come back. But it is going to be slow. While we're still trying to ensure that the infrastructure, that the total capacity in the healthcare system is there as it returns, we want to make sure that we've got that robust availability in Florida now and in the future as our population continues to increase. So it's not as though any hospital can permanently downsize to reduce that overhead.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Really quick.
And the reason why I asked that question is because this is great data, and I'm not quite sure whose hospital is whose, but I just found it interesting, like, for instance, the Nicklaus Health System, at least according to my calculations, 88% of their total impact is because of revenues. But the Baptist Health System, it's 61%. So I'm just curious as the disparity, maybe the definitional issue from the feds on what does revenue mean, but it's just, can you explain why there may be that disparity, that huge disparity of 20-something percent between two different types of hospitals?
So ma'am, can you please be very brief in your answer?
Absolutely. Difference between children's hospital and an adult hospital. So the adult volume would have slightly come back as hospitals were caring for not only COVID patients in the hospital, but non-COVID. Pediatric children's hospitals have continued to see substantially reduced volume, which is what's affecting their revenue.
Thank you for that. I have a series of questions for both of you. As we're pressed for time, please just be as brief as possible, but make sure you get to the substance of the question. Last time you were here, particularly Mrs. Mayhew, you indicated that you would provide the committee with hospital profit margins data. Do you know what those hospital profit margins were in 2019?
Sir, I'm quite sure that I have it. On average, that was a 9% margin in 2019. And again, I apologize for not having the breakdown between rural and pediatric, but we will absolutely get that breakdown for you.
Thank you, ma'am. Please provide that to the committee, all the
Absolutely.
Members. How do those profit margins, right? How do those profit margins for Florida's hospitals, how do they compare to other states? So, in essence, are Florida hospitals doing better than other hospitals relative or compared to other hospitals in other states?
I don't have the comparison national averages, but I can say that obviously what we want from our hospitals is not to be in a constant state of financial crisis. When you're hemorrhaging red ink, you're rarely making good decisions. We can certainly get you that comparison. But there is a reason that our hospitals were at the ready and had the capacity to meet the demand and respond as the state requested over the last year. If you're worried about meeting payroll, awfully challenging to make the investments that we needed.
Mr. Senior?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can tell you our hospitals do, as a group, probably 40 to 50% of the Medicaid. We see 40 to 50% of the Medicaid patients in the state. We also do 40 to 50% of the charity care. So our margins tend to be a little tighter. I mean, nine point something maybe the average. Ours would probably be considerably lower than that, positive operating margins. But it is important that you have a positive operating margin in order to make the investments that you need to make. And to to make sure that you aren't in crisis mode constantly. I certainly agree with that.
Do you know how, you know, and obviously every hospital is very different, but in essence, do you have a general idea if or how much of those profits or those profit margins actually were put into reserves pre-COVID?
Sure. I don't know. I mean, for the most part, our margins would be reinvested in the community because they are public hospitals. So it's public money, and it has to be accounted for in specific ways, or it's affiliated, like for example, with the University of Florida, and it goes into the University of Florida in very specific ways to help their funding. I think that ours tends to be pretty transparent. And it's hard for me to comment on other hospitals and how they may be using their reserves. I have a lot of respect for the hospital industry in Florida, both our members and our non-members.
Thank you. Ms. Mayhew?
In terms of the reserves, as Justin indicated, a lot of that, there are strings attached to how those dollars are used. Often those are set aside for the capital improvements, capital investments. I can't speak to what percentage are put back into reserves, but those reserves help to support community need, preserving access to services, innovation, expanded services. So that would be the focus of any of those reserves, and particularly often used for one-time investments as opposed to ongoing operating expense.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. And part of the reason why I'm asking in terms of reserves is because part of what I requested in the data was how much of that CARES Act funding went into reserves. And I know that both of you shared a concern, I think more so probably you, Mrs. Mayhew, in terms of, you know, any sort of clawback. I don't anticipate that, given the fact that D.C. is about to spend $1.9 trillion. So I don't anticipate that. But
Mr. If I could,
you're recognized.
I just would like to distinguish between what we traditionally think about in terms of hospital reserves that pertain to their credit rating, the day's cash on hand, investment income that they receive. I used the word last week, reserving against, which is different. So their accountants are advising their hospitals, their CFOs, to not treat some of the CARES funding as income until they have thoroughly analyzed their costs and their revenue losses against the final guidance from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services to ensure that what they retain can be reconciled against that guidance. So that is different than putting it into what we would traditionally refer to as hospital reserves.
Thank you for that. And this is to kind of piggyback off of Representative Robinson's question in terms of loss of revenue. In your opinion, is there a clear distinction between operating expenses and loss of revenue?
Well, I'll take a first stab at that. As hospitals plan their budget, as any business, any provider, you are anticipating your overall revenue, and you are budgeting for certain expenditures. The revenue that they would have forecasted for 2020 has been substantially disrupted and impacted by the pandemic. Many of their operating expenses have continued. The cost of their staff, meeting payroll, their physical plant, all of the supplies that are required, and certainly the increased costs associated with the pandemic. So as we evaluate what they would have budgeted, as they have provided information and data to you around their revenue, they are looking at what did they anticipate for revenue this year, but many of those operating expenses have continued throughout the pandemic in order to preserve capacity and then truly to meet the various spikes in COVID hospitalizations that we experienced.
Mr. Senior?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I mean, I would view it the same way. I mean, revenue has to do with the amount that you're receiving from Medicare, from commercial payers, from Medicaid and others. And then the expenses are the various equipment costs, the supply costs that you're going to be incurring, as well as staff augmentation and things like that, some of the additional expenses. Ultimately, both of those things were defined as two separate areas in the Provider Relief Fund. So I think that's kind of guided the way that we're talking with you about it during these last two committee meetings.
Thank you. I mean, and the reason I ask is really when I think about a loss of revenue, it's something that's not baked in necessarily, right? It can vary depending on year, right? You're basing it off of last year's projection in terms of your answer to Representative Robinson, right? Now your operating expenses, right? Now that is an actual budgetary obligation that you have to meet, right? So when you factor in the CARES Act funding, right, which relative to your operating expenses, 8 out of the 10 on this top 10 list actually have a surplus in CARES Act funding of over $295 million. So that is when you factor in, right, the CARES Act funding relative to your actual operating expenses. That's not taking into consideration the loss of revenue, which again is not actually baked in. It's not your, that varies in some cases wildly depending on the circumstances and the years. So I guess my question is, I mean, is there any sort of, you know, any explanation for that?
Mr. Chairman, I guess the lost revenue was simply larger than the expenses. Ultimately, if you want to pay those expenses, you have to have the revenue. I mean, that was the situation, and our hospitals have very tight margins. You know, if you do not have the revenue at a place like UF Health Jacksonville, you're not going to be able to pay your expenses. And that was the situation that the CARES Act was, I think, trying to address, was to make sure that you didn't have a situation where your healthcare infrastructure was fraying or disintegrating while you were trying to deal with a COVID surge. Ultimately, yes, the losses in revenue from all sources were significant. You know, ultimately, the government ordered us shut down, right? That we were going to earn revenue, then we could not. And that was true of all hospitals, not just ours. We had that the ability to earn revenue cut off, and so that created this situation where you had a real danger of not being able to meet your expenses and creating sort of this disintegrating healthcare infrastructure. Instead, we were able to maintain the infrastructure and really convert it, I think, into a good outcome for the state of Florida under very difficult circumstances.
All right. In a simple yes or no, since we're pressed for time. Do you believe that hospitals will be reporting a true net loss given the amount of CARES Act funding, given the amount of DEM supplemental funds for medical staffing, for PPE, for rural hospitals,
yes,
given all of those factors, given the fact that the overall decreases in operating expenses due to underutilization, do you believe that your hospitals will, at the end of the day, report a true net loss? Yes or no?
We have over 30 hospitals. For many of them, the answer will be yes. I don't know as a group what the aggregate would be.
Ms. Mayhew?
There will definitely be hospitals that will be reporting a net loss.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Members, that will conclude this presentation. Members, as we move forward, we have to make sure that we do our due diligence, right, as we are crafting the budget. I hope many of you will ask the tough questions, right, but the necessary ones, right, because we're dealing with public dollars at a very crucial time in our state's history. So with that being said, Representative Snyder moves that we rise. Hearing no objection, we're adjourned.